Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
So welcome to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum or on Twitter at InforumSF. I'm Nick Bilton, columnist and technology reporter for the New York Times. This gentleman here is Tim Ferriss. Tim is an investor, entrepreneur, author of three best-selling books, which he just referred to as the trilogy, which I think that belongs to someone else.
I was raised on Star Wars. I chewed off Boba Fett's head.
I totally get it. And all these books have a four-hour concept. They include the four-hour work week and the four-hour body, where Tim has been on a mission to make people's lives more effective and to help Americans understand that there is more to life than a cubicle. Now with The 4-Hour Chef, his latest book, Tim hopes to teach people how to emulate the world's fastest learners all through the process of food. So I'd like to welcome the bold man to my left, who is too pretty for radio, Tim Ferriss.
Thank you for being here.
Ooh, and we have drinks, Tim.
What
cheers.
Was that? We have drinks. Cheers. Oh, yeah. Well, she's all the food and wine talk, and I realize we don't have wine.
Well...
So I am, we know each other, so he will take the piss out of me as much as he feels necessary. I'm going for the, as Jason Statham says, the upside down face. So I've got to grow this out.
That works. Did you bring food? Because I was told there'd be food here.
No, I figured the less I eat, the cheaper a date I am, so I'll just have one drink at a time.
I'm going to start off with a little story about Tim that's actually in his book. We actually live pretty close to each other, and I was having some people over one night, and texted Tim and said, "Hey, stop by for a drink." And Tim shows up, and I have a little dog. Her name's Pixel. She's really cute. She's 35 pounds. She's a little mutt. She's scared of everything. She's very timid. And Tim shows up, and she starts immediately sniffing Tim's crotch. And very aggressively. And I'm like, "Pixel, back off. Come on, enough." And then she starts humping Tim's leg. And I'm like, I'm really sorry. And I like push her to the side and she continues to do it. And I say to Tim, I was like, "I'm really, really sorry about this." And then eventually he kind of says, "Well, I'm actually really, really sorry about this. I took some testosterone before I came here, cause I'm experimenting for the cookbook. And that's why your dog is humping me." So can you tell us a little bit about what that testosterone did other than get my dog to want to have sex with you?
Right. So I was, as usual, trying to do all of the guinea pig nonsense so that my readers don't have to. And one of the compounds I wanted to play with was pine pollen. And it turns out that pine pollen, which you can get just about anywhere during the right time of year, is biochemically identical to testosterone, androstenedione, et cetera. So you can very easily, you can buy it on Amazon or wherever, you can go gather it yourself and really boost testosterone over the short term. So I was combining that with fat-loading ribeye steak for increasing testosterone. And
did it get you laid?
By the wrong species, yeah. I'm still working on the targeting.
So I shouldn't order some pine pollen right now from the internet?
It's pretty fun to experiment with. It's disgusting. So you'd want to take it as a cold water shot. I tried to make sauces out of it, and it was just horrible. It was as bad as it sounds.
Interesting. He stopped by this afternoon, and Pixel was like, "What's up?
We meet again.
Can you leave?" Yeah. So you're doing a cookbook, and you're trying all these crazy, wacky things. How many times did you get food poisoning?
I got food poisoning once, which was in Calcutta, India. Calcutta. I get corrected by that.
And from pine pollen, or what was it?
It wasn't pine pollen, no. It was, we were at the Taliganj something or other hotel and had contaminated fish. And so ended up in the Calcutta ER for 4 or 5 days.
With most people, I wouldn't ask this, but were you intentionally eating contaminated fish?
No, I was not.
Oh, okay, because I didn't know.
No, you never know. You never know.
You know, feminine hormones.
Yeah, you never know. but after that, I started traveling with, and there's a lot of debate or controversy about this, but grapeseed extract is actually really effective for killing many different strains of bacteria. And I've had staph infections from botched injections. And it's not a weird question at all to ask if I was eating contaminated food, but I'll travel with a little bit of grapeseed extract now, and I'll take a few drops of that if I think something's suspect. And you can actually use that in certain circumstances to.
And so you eat the bad fish and then you take it, or
right? If I think something is off, then I'll use that as insurance.
Are there any side effects, or?
You just don't want to have too much of it. It's very, very strong stuff.
Got it. did you experiment with any drugs while you were doing this book? Some legal ones?
I like
ones,
this.
Some
it's
illegal
heavy
ones.
Hitting in the beginning. It's like go from having like pseudo-sexual encounters with your dogs to illicit substances.
I'm going to ask what music you listen
this
to
is
now.
Right.
You know, sex, drugs, rock.
Right. I did experiment with a lot of drugs. I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on the internet either. So caveat emptor. But in the name of science, I've played around with quite a few purported smart drugs. So that ranged from vasopressin, or the synthetic version of vasopressin, which is desmopressin, which I actually expect that was more wine. I was like, this is great. Keep it coming. The vasopressin I used as early as freshman year in college for studying Chinese characters before class. And I would take one shot in each nostril and then flip through pages of characters almost as fast as I could turn the pages, and so usually score 95 to 100%. It's typically prescribed for children who bedwet past a certain age. It's an anti-diuretic hormone. It's naturally occurring.
Do you wet your bed?
Well, it was a fringe benefit. I stopped wetting my bed.
Got it.
It has implications for short-term memory, and it's very fast-acting. It's also, as a side note, why if you drink a whole lot and you time travel, i.e. forget what the hell happened or where you were, it's due to a tie-in with vasopressin. So I tried that. I tried hydrogen, modafinil, and Provigil, but that's kind of par for the course. Very popular in Silicon Valley. And then a lot of weirder stuff.
So how does the drug that that stops you from wetting the bed help your memory? What is it actually doing?
Well, it's a peptide as in many cases, has effects outside of just preventing you from wetting your bed.
Got it.
And if you look at, let's say, the discovery and development marketing of drugs like Viagra, oftentimes they're developed for one purpose.
Did you take Viagra while you were writing the book?
I might have, but had nothing to do with the book. if I did, it had nothing to do with the book, ostensibly. I digress. So that was, maybe someone can correct me here, but it was originally developed for some type of cardiac condition. What was that?
Blood pressure.
Right, exactly. And then they're like, oh, wait a second, the side effect is actually more profitable. Let's go after that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You chose to publish this book with Amazon. The other two books in the trilogy with Boba Fett were not. They were regular publishers. Yeah. As a result, you are not in, I believe, 1,100 traditional bookstores. Barnes & Noble wants to beat you up, and I'm sure you've lost a few friends along the way. If you could go back in time, would you do it again with Amazon?
Yeah, I would do it again. I'll tell you why. But I want to explain the trilogy thing because that sounds kind of silly without any context. I've been idolized is maybe a strong word, but not really too excessive. So Ben Franklin's always been a real hero of mine. And his trinity was healthy, wealthy, and wise. And so I really have spent a lot of time obsessing in those three areas. And healthy was a four-hour body, wealthy was a four-hour work week, and then wise, with a focus on learning, was intended to be this one. So I really do see this as a certain type of closure. We can come to that later. But Amazon Publishing, I would sign with again.
You would?
I would. And there are many reasons for that. It has not been easy, as anyone who's watched it has seen. Certainly being boycotted at Barnes & Noble can be very crippling from the standpoint of reporting to things like the New York Times, for instance, which is very heavily biased towards print retail. But what Amazon Publishing afforded me was, number one, the opportunity to communicate directly with customers. Most people don't realize that traditional publishers are business-to-business companies. You are not their customers. Their customers are the head category buyer at Barnes & Noble, the head category buyer at Books A Million, whereas Amazon can communicate with tens of millions of people. So the opportunity to experiment in that sandbox was really appealing. And secondly, I would just say I'd done the traditional thing twice. I know how it works. it does work, but I wanted to try something new. And what Amazon, with the boycott and everything else, what that forced me to do, and I expected that would happen, is do things like partner with BitTorrent or try all of these unorthodox things that I really hadn't been forced to try.
Yep.
Since the very first book and the first week of the first book.
Did it affect sales at all? Not being in traditional bookstores?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there'll be more on this when the lists come out this weekend, but they came out to Publishing Insiders today, with the exception of Wall Street Journal, which I think comes out Friday. But it will absolutely affect sales, and it also affects reporting. So I won't spend too much time on the lists. It's a fascinating study, though, looking at how these different lists compare. So if you look at USA Today, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, they are all helter-skelter. There's no real consensus at all. And I would say that pretty cleanly you can look at my sales and assume that I would have had the 20,000, let's say, additional copies that I moved in digital would have been pretty cleanly moved to print. If I had not been with Amazon but fully stocked by Barnes & Noble. And that has a huge impact on the list. What's very curious to me, and unfortunate in my particular case, is that if you look at the ebook bestseller list on the New York Times, there are no advice, how-to, or miscellaneous books. That means no cookbooks, nothing. And so my book was by far and away the best-selling nonfiction book on all of Amazon, print and digital, last week, and my book will not appear on the New York Times ebook bestseller list. Even though by magnitudes of order, it was the best.
Freaking New York Times.
I know these guys. Talk to your friends. But that's the game that I chose to play. And love it or hate it, I knew that was one penalty I might pay. But my goal is not to have a book that debuts for 1 week, like something in a movie theater.
Yep.
I look at this. It's not over. I have plenty left. I won't go too long, but.
Good, you know, I'm about to interrupt you.
I know you're about to interrupt me. That's why I saw you starting to like twitch in the corner of your mouth. Mm-hmm. I iterate not just with products and startups and whatnot, but with distribution. So it was very unclear what would report, what would not, what would be discounted, what would not be. And so I still have a lot of powder left in the keg. I did not spend it all on the first week because I knew there was the distinct possibility that, let's say, the book would be underreported by 7,000-8,000 copies, which is exactly what happened on Bookscan. So we'll see what happens.
So one of the things that with Kindles and things like that, when you transition from print books to these devices, I think, you know, traditional novels and things like that work very well. Cookbooks don't.
Yeah.
Why didn't you do an app or something like that instead?
Function of time in this particular case.
Got it.
I mean, I designed this book. So I, for ages, and we just talked about this on the way over here, but wanted to be a comic book penciler. Always wanted to be in graphic design in some fashion, and was an illustrator in school for a period of time, illustrated books for Princeton. And this was my opportunity to create something beautiful. And one of the aspects of this book, as it relates to Amazon Publishing, that not many people talk about, is the fact that it's a 672-page full-color book that sells for $21. I cannot think of a single publisher out there who would ever bite that bullet and do that. So I designed this book as two-page spreads, and I didn't realize until kind of late in the game, I was like, you don't really have two-page spreads in digital. I did hear one of the benefits of living in Silicon Valley was, because I've gotten to know the people at Amazon over time, because I wanted faster changes on my Amazon page, for instance, even with my previous two books. And at one point I was talking to them, and it was early on, before anything happened. They're like, well, you know, cookbooks don't really translate well to black and white Kindle, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah. And one of the benefits of living here is you hear a lot of rumors. And I said, well, that's true, but hypothetically, if you guys had a device coming out
Why didn't
soon
you give me that scoop?
That could use full color to showcase a cookbook.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'll call you back. And I think they did a very good job with the digital, but I, from the very outset, was trying to create a beautiful tactile experience.
Yep. Speaking of killing things, you killed things for your book. Does chicken taste different when you've ripped its head off and drank the blood and poured it over your body? I mean, does that Does it taste better? Or?
I'll tell you what it does. So I was always an anti-hunter. Never killed things.
You're not vegetarian or anything?
No, I'm not vegetarian, but I grew up on Long Island, and there's a pretty decent bow season for deer on Long Island. And I grew up with, to my mind, very disrespectful hunters who would like throw empty beer cans in our driveway and go on our property, shoot deer, and we'd have these maimed deer that would die on our property who weren't hunted properly. And so I developed this real aversion to hunting. Until I came to this book and I was putting together the wild section and wanted to force myself to reconnect with these ingredients, whether it was foraging or hunting, whatever. And Steve Rinella, all you guys should take a look at him. Steve Rinella is a fascinating guy, excellent writer, and took me on this first hunt. And whether it's slaughtering a chicken or hunting a deer, what's most interesting to me is what happens after the kill is made. So really going through the entire field dressing process.
What is that moment like? I mean, how many people in here have killed an animal and eaten it? Wow,
yeah, decent.
I'm impressed. Yeah. I killed a cockroach once.
Yeah. What is
that feeling like? You're sitting there behind and you see. I'm sorry, I don't mean to point. I'll point the gun.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Like, is there a feeling of guilt about what you're about to do, or is it based on the fact that you're about to eat it different?
I think it's very person by person. I do not have any guilt associated with the hunts that I've gone on. I've gone on a few now, because I use everything. I mean, I have the hides. I'm making gloves out of the hides. I have everything. I use all of it, and I don't have any guilt associated with that. The impact that it has, which I think is very valuable, is it makes me extremely conscious of what I'm eating. And throwing away meat now does make me feel very guilty.
Got it.
And I think
do you think that that parents should, you know, take the lessons in the book and take their kids hunting? Or I mean, is it?
I think teaching your kids where food comes from is important. Absolutely. And I mean, the macro goal of the book, which I talk about, is to try to preserve many independent small scale farms as opposed to having all of it go up for grabs when farmers retire in the next, let's say, 10 years, 50% of them or so, to, let's say, Monsanto. I mean, okay, that's like cheap applause for like pointing a finger at Monsanto, but it's pretty accurate. And I think that all of that starts at home when people are voting three times a day with what they eat. So I think teaching your kids where food comes from and that there's a cost to eating animal protein.
Yep.
And like, I'm not a vegetarian. I have no plan to be one. But understanding what's involved in procuring that protein, I think, is really important.
Did you you killed a lot of vegetables too, huh?
I did. Slaughtered a lot of broccoli.
What's your favorite recipe in the book? If you had to pick one.
Yeah, if I had to pick one, it would be the first recipe. The very first recipe in the book is ossobuco, but I spell it B-U-K-O for a lot of reasons. It's a variation. Also means that I own that for SEO. so that if I say to someone, look for an ossobuco recipe, okay, then they find the right one.
Yeah.
But the ossobuco recipe is the first recipe because it is typically a very expensive recipe item. Menu item.
Yeah.
$30-$35, let's say. And it is easier to make amazing ossobuco using veal or lamb for, let's say, 4 to 6 people than it is to make good scrambled eggs for 1 or 2 people.
Wow.
There's no cutting involved. There's next to no prep. And I'll just tell you the recipe. Here it is. All right. And I might miss something, and it doesn't matter. Because the first few recipes are designed to have the largest margin of safety possible, just like Warren Buffett does his investing, right? All right, here it is. So you get, let's just say it's for 4 people. Get 4 lamb shanks. You don't have to cut them. It's fine. All right. A couple of carrots. You're going to scrub them. You don't have to peel them. Scrub them. Break them by hand. Put them in the bottom of a cast iron, let's say Dutch oven. That's the bedding. Okay. Put in the veal shank, lamb shanks or veal shanks. Pour in a can of tomatoes. So it's usually 14 ounces. It doesn't really matter. Okay, boom. Bunch of salt and pepper. Put in more than you think you need. 3/4 of a bottle of white wine. Drink the rest if you want. That's usually what I do. And you're done. You take that. You put it in an oven at 350 degrees for 2.5 hours. And the first time I made that for someone, they go, I'm not kidding. This is like a self-described foodie in San Francisco. They go, dude, you should start the Tim Ferriss restaurant. And I told him how easy it was, and he was like, I want to rescind my statement. It's amazing. You should all try it out. It's so, and when you do that to someone, which is like, when you take something they perceive as complicated and show them how easy it can be, that then gives them the confidence and the positive feedback to tackle everything else in the book. Because it's such a shift. And so I'd say that's my favorite recipe. Like, that's my go-to. Like, for Christmas, try it once before Christmas, obviously. But it's like, if that's your holiday, whatever. Try it. It's so good. It's so easy. Try it.
All right. Sold. Does anyone have any with them?
Yeah.
No? All right, switching gears a little bit. If you type Tim Ferriss is into Google, the autocomplete is not very nice.
Oh, yeah.
The first thing it says is Tim Ferriss is a fake. The second thing it says is Tim Ferriss is a liar. The third thing it says is Tim Ferriss is a douche.
Ooh.
And
nice. That's my favorite, personally.
Well, actually, there's one better. The next one is Tim Ferriss is a douchebag. I didn't know they were two different things.
Yeah.
Douchebag. Anyway.
I would think one is a verb.
Yes.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah. Why don't these people like you?
I have my own theories. I mean, I saw a YouTube comment, which was, that guy's face is just so punchable. And
sorry about that. I was having a bad day.
Oh, yeah. You know, I thought I'm like, N. Bilton? Really? Is that the same guy? For whatever reason, I mean, and I have my theories, but I'm very polarizing, it seems.
Yeah.
So there are very few people in the middle.
No, and absolutely. And the thing I noticed was that it's like in the comments on these forums that these link to, like, some people are like, yeah, he's a douche or a douchebag, and other people are like, no, he's amazing, I love him and want to have
his children. It's very binary, and I think that I don't think this is limited to me. I think that
I don't know, if you type in my name, Nick Bilton is, it's like super hot, really smart.
Yeah, right. Nick Bilton is super hot.
Yeah,
my future ex-boyfriend. Right. I think that anyone who has a strong opinion about anything in a digital age will polarize. And there are pros and cons to that. I make very bold claims when I feel like I have enough evidence or empirical data to back it up. And I don't shy away from that. I think that provokes a lot of different responses in people. But the worst place I could end up is in the middle ground where everyone has a lukewarm response. And I don't provoke simply to get a strong response. I do my homework. But do I take something like, for instance, in the 4-Hour Chef, the competitive eating day that I had with the bodybuilder eating a Vermonster. This is a, like, 14,000 calorie tub of ice cream from Ben & Jerry's. It's intended to be shared by like 8 people. Brownies and cookies and all that. It's silly. It's excessive.
Mm-hmm.
But I use that to draw people in who would otherwise not give a damn about anything with chef or cookbook in it, and then teach what I want. So it's a Trojan horse. And I think a lot of people who criticize me for being hyperbolic or excessive or whatever miss that point. That is the most effective way to impact a large number of people. But
How does it make you feel personally? I mean,
it's a good question. I'd be lying if I said it didn't bother me sometimes.
Yeah.
But I remember really early on when my first book came out and I had some 1-star review. And I wrote this huge, lengthy response to this 1-star review, like, "Dear Jonathan," or whatever his name was, like, "I totally understand your position, but you might not realize that this, this, and this." And I think he wrote back. He's just like, "Fuck you, douchebag." And I was just like, And then I talked to a female friend of mine who's a very popular blogger.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, it's so tough because of this and that." And she goes, this is literally what she says. She goes, "Dude, grow some balls." She's like, "I get rape threats and death threats every week." She's like, "Get used to it. This is what you signed up for."
Yep.
And that's just the sad reality. If you want to make an impact, you better be prepared to receive an impact. In a digital world, like, put on your body armor. It's a full contact sport.
When I did my first book, the first review was awful. I mean, most of the reviews were really great, and the first one was awful. I smoked cigarettes back then. I went downstairs to the New York Times, and David Carr was out there smoking a cigarette, and he's like, "What's wrong with you?" And I was like, "I got this terrible review, and I'm going to write back." And he actually said to me, "Spitballs on a battleship, you know, the spitballs."
Yeah.
And he's like, "You're the battleship. they're the spitballs and just ignore them. And yeah. And it was quite possibly the best advice that I think.
That's
I
good advice. That's good advice. The advice
because you can't win.
You can't win. So yeah. The other two pieces of advice. If anyone's dealing with anything like this, oh, you're an enabler. there are two pieces of advice that I found very helpful from friends who have even more exposure than I do, which is a lot of people. And they said, number one, starvative oxygen. First response, starvative oxygen. The more you respond, the more you're going to send Google juice
yep.
to whatever it is. And the second part was you're pointing out that people can either build themselves up or tear other people down. It's easier to tear other people down. And you're always going to continue.
Nick Denton, who runs Gawker, he said the rule is you never respond. Like, yeah. that's the best way to deal with these things.
Yeah, so. And who was it?
But it is nice every once in a while to go and call someone a douchebag on a comment.
Yeah, it's there's certain something gratifying about it. But I would say also the third piece of advice, I'll give bonus credit, is assume you are dealing with someone with infinite time.
Yes.
Do you really want to engage that person? Assume you're dealing with someone with infinite time.
Well, you know what I've found actually has been really helpful recently? So because I work at the New York Times, I can't respond and say negative things because they will end up on some sort of blog or publication. And
it
so,
must be hell for you.
Yeah. No, well, no, it's fine. I mean, I really actually enjoy it. It's like a fun sport to wake up on a Sunday morning and see how people have told me I'm an idiot. the thing that I do is I respond politely. Always respond politely, and 99% of the time, people respond and say, "Now I feel bad for what I said."
Yeah, and I never respond violently on my own blog, for instance. Like I view that as my living room. And number one, if someone and the
but right, I think you do have a responsibility to correct people's to correct facts if people are factually wrong.
Most of the time, there are some cases where people know there are so many cases. And I don't want to go too far into this, but if you get any degree of visibility. Or any degree of followers, unique visitors to your blog, whatever, you will have people who write complete fiction about you to provoke a response from you. And like there are so many... I remember a while back, I was meeting with this guy from Belgium, tech entrepreneur, and he's like, "Well, my partners are very concerned about your Wikipedia page." And I was like, "My Wikipedia page?" And so I hadn't seen it in a few months, and I went there, and I was like, "Oh, my God." Like, someone has spent 100 hours just, like, vandalizing this thing.
Yeah.
And it reminded me, so I'm friends with, I know the Ellsbergs, so Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers, right? And he was being interviewed on radio at one point. And they just went to Wikipedia, which a lot of people do. And there's a weird phenomenon called the Wikipedia echo effect, which you can look up. But he's being introduced, and this is a sympathetic interviewer. And the guy goes, "Please, I'm so pleased to welcome Daniel Ellsberg, one of the most notorious traitors in U.S. history." He's just reading on Wikipedia. It's like, oh. So if you're going to be out there again, put on your flak jacket.
I was in Mexico last week. I took my first vacation in a couple of years, even though I was working while I was there. But I was sitting on the beach, and I was, drinking a beer and watching the sunset. And I was sitting there thinking to myself, we all work so hard to get to somewhere where we have to do no work.
Yeah.
And your original concept for the 4-hour work week was that.
Yeah.
Yet you work probably more than most people that I know. Do you not drink your own medicine? What's going on there?
Yeah, this is I think actually so the root of a lot of the attacks, right? Is 4-hour work week, Tim Ferriss, he's the hardest working man in showbiz. This is bullshit. And the point they miss, I think, if they were to actually read the book, I've never had someone who has read the book come up to me and have a dispute about this, is that the objective is, among others, to maximize your per-hour output so you then have the choice of dialing back. You have the choice, the option. So, for instance, I'm going to take all of February off. I can do that. I can say no, hit stop or pause and do that. But during book launch on something that I've worked on for the last 2 years, you have to spend your time on something. The objective of the 4-hour work week isn't to like drop LSD and stare at a wall every day of your life. It's to control time so that you can choose the highest leverage activities. So in this particular case, like on this book launch, I'm 24/7. I mean, I've been literally, and I have the sort of experimentation and drugs and diet and whatnot to do this. I've been averaging probably 2 to 3 hours of sleep a night. And that's very much deliberate because this, the 4-hour chef is the highest leverage thing I could possibly do right now. And I think that one of the keys is to either be fully on or fully off.
So when does this all end, though, for you? I mean, are you going to be, 95 and writing the 4-hour book because you're moving so slowly? Like, I mean, what's like,
measuring dog ears,
right? Yeah.
Pixel ears. I'm in no rush. I'm not in a rush, and I don't feel compelled to continue with the 4-hour moniker at all. This could very well be the last 4-hour book. I'll continue to do experiments and hopefully teach. I always wanted to be a teacher. I never wanted to be a writer. I always wanted to be a teacher.
So how did you end up writing?
I ended up writing because I was in, let's see, this was during my whole walkabout starting in 2004 that then led to the 4-hour work.
Can you give the 140-character version of your walkabout?
Girlfriend breaks up with me, existential crisis, redesign business, travel for 18 months.
140 characters.
Yeah.
Can I retweet that?
You can retweet that. And but during that trip, I ended up in Argentina, which was supposed to be a 4-week trip, ended up being a 9-month trip. And I did tango every day and then ended up in the World Championships and blah, blah, blah. It's a long story. It's in the 4-Hour Chef. Wink. Available on Amazon.com. But anyway, so the... that's more wine. This is going to get increasingly more interesting. So the point being, I had a student, so I taught a guest lecture to students at Princeton in high-tech entrepreneurship, a class, ELE 491. And I talked about lifestyle design and blah, blah, blah. I did it via phone. It was the first time I sort of introduced this term, lifestyle design. And one of the students, I always sent out feedback forms, and one of the students in his additional comments said, I don't understand, this is typical Princeton fashion. He's like, I don't understand why you're teaching a class of 50 students. Why don't you just write a book and be done with it? Ha, ha, ha. And it was like, it was not a serious recommendation at all. It was just a snarky comment. And I was like, that's stupid. I don't want to write. Because my senior thesis had practically killed me. I vowed that I would never write anything longer than an email ever again after graduating. Didn't quite work out. But I would have this insomnia, and I would take down notes just to get them out of my head on, like, potential book chapters, subjects, whatever. And I took these notes, and they got thicker and thicker and thicker. Eventually sent some of it off to Jack Canfield, who I'd come to know long, long ago, and said, Jack, am I full of crap, or is there something here? And he said, I was hoping he would come back. I really was hoping he'd come back and just be like, no, you should really sit this one out. And he wrote back and said, and he's like, I'll introduce you to these three people. I think you should totally do it. I see this is perfect for Fox and Friends. And I was like, Fox, what is Fox and Friends? And sent it out, got turned down by every agent except for one. Only takes one, Steve Hanselman, who had just become an agent. And then he put together, along with me, a proposal, got turned down by 26 publishers. But again, only takes one. And the last one was Crown. And here we are.
A writer who can tweet in public.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you just said, full of crap. We were talking on the way over here. Most people are full of crap. I meet a lot of CEOs, a lot of startups, especially in the industries that I cover and in this world and in a space where you're reinventing something. Mm-hmm. Do you think that too?
Do I think a lot of people are full of crap?
Yeah. And is there anything wrong with that? Is it like?
Yeah, so that's an important question. I think a lot of people are full of crap, and
there's a world that you and I could be like passing a 40 back and forth on the street rather than sitting up here.
Right,
like,
right.
Like
yeah, absolutely. I think that early in a career, you have to be good at hustling and scrapping. End of story. You have to make things happen because no one is going to make them happen for you. And ultimately, I think that is what makes someone an entrepreneur. It's not owning your own company. It's making something from nothing. And this is true with, let's say, like fundraising. Mm-hmm. It's like no one, like VCs are supposed to be these forward-thinking, blah, blah, blah. And there are a few out there, but most of it's me too.
Yeah.
No one wants to invest first. So it's like, all right, well, I have to trick these guys into thinking that these guys are investing. And it's like a three-card Monty game.
Lemmings.
But when, like we were talking about earlier, once you get to a position where you have to execute, that separates the sort of good bullshitters from bad bullshitters. And the people who are good actually then develop a world-class skill set to execute. So I think that you have to be a good communicator.
If you had to describe yourself, so you started out years ago in the 4-hour work week. I'm getting confused which one I'm referencing. In one of those four-hour books that you've done, you said, you know, you used to say that you were, quote-unquote, a drug dealer because you sold
sports supplements.
And, you know, I introduced you as an investor, as a this, as a that. Like, what would you describe yourself as?
The pithy one is human guinea pig, but I view myself as a teacher. I don't think I'm the best writer at all. I mean, you know, I had the great, wonderful fortune of studying nonfiction with John McPhee. Like, that guy could mop the floor with me any day of the week. I mean, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. But I do think I have perhaps a gift at taking complicated, overwhelming amounts of data and distilling it into a logical sequence that people feel they can actually follow. And it's not Hemingway. Maybe it's not worthy of any writing prizes. But in terms of results for my readers, I view myself as a teacher. And the books just happen to be the medium through which I teach. But a few years from now, or even a year from now, will that be TV? Will that be online video? Will it be something else? I don't know. But I'm not wedded to the format of print. So I would say teacher, aspiring teacher.
You're not wedded to the format of print or books, but don't you see that the future of media is this thing that is in encompassed by everything, by, you know, people that have a blog and a Twitter account and a Facebook account and write books and they do TV shows and this and that and the other? Isn't it all the same thing? It's just a different type, form of storytelling?
I think it can be, as long as you don't sacrifice your material for the medium. What I mean by that is I meet many people who are just getting started and they're not good at any one delivery mechanism. And they feel like they need to have 360-degree tool coverage. And they're like, oh, my God, this new thing just came out. Ah, tool du jour. Boom. And they want to add that to their repertoire of 20 things. And I think you should get good at communicating through one medium before you start spreading yourself too thin. And once you have some content, in this particular case, that you feel is good, then you can adapt it for just about anything. Like the BitTorrent, I mean, it's a good example. So this BitTorrent.
I'm just going to interrupt you for one second. We have in 10 minutes. We're going to do, excuse me, Q&A at the microphones. If you want to ask questions and keep them short. If you go over, Tim used to be a kickboxing expert, and I will unleash him on you. And if not, I will beat the crap out of you with one of these. So anyway, carry on.
I was just going to say the BitTorrent partnership is a good example of going cross-platform once you have confidence in, let's say, the print or the digital version of the book. I have hundreds of megabytes, probably gigs, of video behind the scenes, the making of scans of early edits.
Yeah.
And I do think that we're reaching a point where, and this is a good thing, you can't, this coming back to your bullshit point, like you cannot BS your way onto, let's say, any of the bestseller lists for a long period of time.
Yeah.
Because things are transparent now. If it's bad, it's bad. And it will come out. If it's good, it's good. That's why I'm not in a rush. I'm like, look, I have 300-something reviews, like 4.5 stars. I'm in no rush at all. Like, I hope to have 1,000 within 4 weeks. And, like, I to the chagrin of the, you know, the people who hate me so much, like, I plan on sticking around for a long time.
When can we expect your embarrassing media plagiarism sex scandal that usually happens with authors? Is that coming soon?
Or? Oh, my sex tape?
Yeah, what's...
I don't know. When's Pixel available?
I'm kidding. She's licking her hair this weekend. So is the 4-hour franchise, is it done? I mean, I'm sure you get... all the time, when are you going to do the 4-hour pregnancy or the 4-hour...
yeah.
The 4-hour author or the 4... I mean, somebody said that you should do the 4-hour sex books, but if you spoke to your girlfriend, it would be the 4-minute sex book.
Oh,
I mean,
what yes, would, indeed. Efficiency.
Is this the last one, or...?
I think it could be, honestly. Here's the thing. If I wanted to monetize the 4-hour brand, mm-hmm. I could have... stopped writing books after the first book and licensed the hell out of it. And I chose not to do that because the goal is not to have as many products or services as possible with 4-hour attached to it. I think these three books make a nice set, and I think it completes a lot of what I want to cover. It could be the last.
Four-hour books would be better than three.
Yes, indeed. I know. That's true. What do you call it? It's not a trilogy. Quadrilogy?
A quadrilogy.
I think it's the last.
Call Lucasfilms. They'll help you out with that.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the last. And I'm excited to try something new.
just two more questions, and then we'll move on. But when you think about all of these books that you've done, you're essentially almost like a life hacker, right? You're hacking life in many different ways, whether it's from work, the way we cook, the way we exercise, all of these different things. Where does that come from? Were you beaten up as a child, and this is the way of responding? Like, is it an insecurity, or is it just that you think that things should work differently?
It's a combination. I was beat up as a child. I was a runt until sixth grade. So, I mean, I was born premature. I had my ass kicked constantly up until about sixth grade. I think it comes from a few things. Number one, my parents were great teachers, and they never wanted me to say, you know, count to French and 10 or whatever it was. They exposed me to a lot and looked for something that could be the gateway interest, and then they would plow their support into it. So I was very curious from a young age, thanks to them. Secondly, I think the self-experimentation started with wrestling, and I wrestled for a very long time and was an All-American in high school. And I could not control my body temperature. My thermoregulation was off because of my left lung and the preemie stuff. So I had to focus on other things, like losing weight, and specific techniques. And so I was routinely cutting 20-plus pounds of water weight twice a week to compete. And when you do that, in order not to kill yourself or to just get pinned in the first 10 seconds, you have to track things like potassium. You have to understand things like sodium. So I think that's where a lot of the self-tracking started. And then on the mental side, which is pretty much all of the 4-Hour Chef, I mean, it could have just been called the 4-Hour Mind in a lot of ways, was the year abroad that I spent in Japan from 15 to 16, where I just failed repeatedly, could not learn Japanese up until about the 5 or 6 month point, and then ended up improvising and using Japanese comic books and judo textbooks to learn Japanese, among other things. And it worked. And once that happened, and at the same time I'm asking myself, like the fact that we drive on the right side of the road is totally arbitrary. The fact that, you know, Japanese people bathe before they get into the bathtub, like, it's all, like, all these rules are just made up.
Yep.
They're just made up.
Yep.
I think all of those things combined have just led me to be very curious about testing those assumptions. And I did that long before the books, and I'm going to continue to do it.
Speaking of, perfect segue to my last question. In all of your books, I think, if I'm correct, you repeatedly quote Mark Twain, and you a saying that is, whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. With the continuation of these 4-hour branded books and the fact that you are now the majority, don't you think it's time to pause and reflect?
Oh, yeah. That's the plan for the next 2 months. I wouldn't say I'm in the majority. Certainly not if you Google Tim Ferriss is. But I think it's hugely important to reflect, and I, even more so than Mark Twain, although I'm a huge fan of Mark Twain. But some of you may know my somewhat odd obsession with Seneca the Younger, letters from a Stoic, and Stoicism in general. I think that a lot of the mistakes we make in modern life are due to undervaluing the things that are easily obtained. And I'm absolutely going to take a pause. I'm going to hit time out for hopefully not just February, but beyond. And I shouldn't be in a rush. There's no need to be in a rush. And I enjoy teaching. I'm looking for the next subject and the next best opportunity and vehicle for doing that. But yeah, I agree. Time to reflect.
We have time for some questions if you want to wander over to the mic and ask away. Once again, try to keep them under 100. Maybe let's try to keep under 10 characters, the questions.
Hi, Tim. My name's Tim, too. But the question I have is, one of the challenges with any person bringing on a new regime, be it a new diet, a new workout plan, like, you know, vitamins or whatnot, is maintaining that regime. So in your experience, in your research, what are the things that cause people to all of a sudden go stop doing that regime, and what are the ways to actually fight that and keep that regime going?
Good question. All right. Behavioral change is, at its core, what I study That's the layer beneath all these different...
And I'm going to ask you to not take too long, too, because we have a lot to...
No problem.
Yeah. I will kick your ass.
I know you will. You've got pointy shoes. I don't want to get hit with those. The short answer is, number one, the best way to maintain a habit is not to expect yourself to follow it at all times. Number two is to simultaneously recognizing that adherence to habits ebbs and flows. The mistake that people make is they say, all right, I've had this diet, I just digressed, therefore I should just throw it all out and I'm going to eat cookies for the next 6 months because I had one cookie. And I think that is flawed on a lot of levels. There are tools you can use like Lyft, which I'm involved with, which was incubated by the Twitter guys out of Obvious. But the last point I'll make is one new habit at a time. The best way to avoid abandoning new habits is to only adopt one at a time. And one of the issues with cooking, and this will be my last point, is when people say, I want to learn how to cook, they're typically trying to adopt five or so new habits at a time. Grocery shopping, prep, cooking, cleaning. Of course you're going to fail. So just picking one at a time is really important.
Before we go to the next question, I forgot to read my radio thing, so I'm going to get beat up. As a reminder to our audience, the program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting Tim Ferriss of the 4-Hour Movement, the trilogy series. I'm Nick Bilton, technology and business columnist for the New York Times. And Tim Ferriss is an investor, entrepreneur, author of The 4-Hour Body, The 4-Hour Work Week, and now The 4-Hour Chef, and soon The 4-Hour Pregnancy. You are up next.
I'm following The 4-Hour Pregnancy. So I'm actually really curious if you think that there are habits or things that cannot be learned using your formula.
Good question.
Some that I would like to learn that I don't think is possible.
This is helpful. Which ones?
Well, now I'm just going to sound like a crazy woman.
But compared to me, no.
I'm actually really interested in like how to read bird patterns, augury, okay. Just these random things that I feel like are maybe they're more mystical of nature, or like relating to people, or you know, certain meditations that I don't think we can just learn, or ways of being we can't just learn via.
So I would say that whenever you're targeting a new skill, specificity is key. So having a very clear definition of what success in that skill means. Quantified whenever possible. If not, then it's extremely hard to deconstruct, right? But the basic framework in the 4-Hour Chef, which is this DIS process, the deconstruction, selection, which is 80-20, sequencing, and then stakes, can be applied to anything, especially the stakes. That's the easiest one, which is not stakes like stakes, but ST, like steak, vampire heart steak. The part of the reason this book took me so long to put together, because this should have been my first book, because it allowed everything else that I've done, is because with the previous processes I tried, they didn't hold up with like sports, languages, all these different things. So this process, I think, really does apply to everything I've tried, certainly.
Thank you.
Of course.
You're up next.
Tim, I just want to say, first off, love your philosophies. Thank you for introducing us to that. So my question is, when you were starting BrainQuicken, your supplement company, you talk about test before you invest. What are some maybe two or three really key business or marketing things that you learned over the years that if somebody is looking to start their own company or start their own product, especially on the internet, that you'd recommend?
You can answer one. I'm just kidding.
Okay. Yeah. All right. The test before you invest is something that I've also carried over to startups. If your goal is a income-based business, as opposed to playing the VC back game, right? Which is a different story. Different story. Let's just assume your goal is revenue or income. Then my recommendation, two things. The short answer is read a post that Noah Kagan, K-A-G-A-N, wrote on my blog. But identifying the market and ensuring that the market exists in sufficient numbers, as well as being inexpensive to reach, so that you can then design a product or a service for that market, is the best route to take. And that's market validation, but product development. But Noah Kagan wrote a fantastic blog post on this on my blog. So if you just search his name and on my blog, then it'll pop right up.
Thank you.
Of course.
Hey, Tim. My name's Nick. I'm the son of two teachers, so I appreciate that you fashion yourself as a teacher. One of the questions I had was regarding, with the new book and your career of self-experimentation, what was one of the most difficult things that you've taught yourself to learn, and why was that more difficult? Was it just a matter of complexity, of time? What was that?
This is a good question. Rapid fire. I'll just give three that are super short. Swimming and basketball, because I feared them for so long. Swimming, because I had had near-drowning experiences and just had failed so many times. Basketball, because I had a junior high PE coach humiliate me in front of a whole group of students. And so I was just like, I'm never going to be good at this. I'm going back to wrestling. That was more emotional, sort of fear-based. I had just written it off completely. Like, beyond negotiation, I cannot do these things. And then, of course, stupid. Like, in a weekend, it was like, which is a reflection of the process, not of any ability that I have. And I would say cooking was the other, because I saw cooking as one skill, and I didn't take the time to deconstruct it and break it down into these component parts. Like I said, the grocery shopping, the prep, the cooking, the cleanup. So I was like, all right, well, let me take away the grocery shopping, figure out how to automate or pretty much eliminate that. Prep, let me get rid of that. Let me get rid of the cleanup by using, let's say, disposable plates for the first 2 weeks. And then boom, like magic, and then I'm cooking. And it took me a long time to figure that out, which is kind of embarrassing.
So a lot of this is figuring out, rather than taking on a large number of things, is figuring out how to take on one.
Yeah, like if you want to learn the guitar, for instance, it's a common fantasy, watch Axis of Awesome on YouTube. They use 4 or 5 chords to play every pop song you could possibly imagine in like 5 minutes. It's just like, it makes it so unintimidating. And I think that's true with most skills. Thanks.
Hi, Mr. Ferris. My name is Cody. So it's my understanding from your upbringing that you had a lot of struggles and a lot of adversity. I was very interested in all of that. Now that you have rooms full of people hanging on every word and you have so many people thinking that you're awesome, one, how do you deal with staying grounded, and how do you remain humble? And the second part of the question is, what would the fifth grade you think about who you are now?
Okay. The way I stay grounded is by hanging out with people like this. but just friends who are, number one, going to give me unending hell if my head gets too big. Secondly, by hanging out with people who, from my perspective, are a hell of a lot more impressive than I am. And that's also me. Not to beat a dead horse, but reading Stoicism puts things in perspective. Like, this could all be taken away from me in a moment's notice, right? Like that. Like, some fabricated scandal, boom. Like, 99% of you guys are gone. And that, I think, is very important. Fifth grade version of me would have been like, why the hell are you not a marine biologist? That's what I wanted to be at that time. But I did do shark tagging last year, so... it's kind of weird looking for like approval from my fifth grade self. But yeah, I think he'd be pretty happy. I don't think he'd be totally disappointed. He'd be wondering what the hell's going on here, but it's all right.
I agree.
Yeah, exactly.
Hello, Tim, everyone. I'm Rory. I wanted to ask you about your first business. And if you could go back in time and know what you know now, how would you do things differently and in any aspect? Not just a business, maybe just in your terms of lifestyle and or relationships.
In terms of my first business, I think it was pretty well executed with sports nutrition. I mean, there was the sort of clinical scientific grounding, which was also with the help of people I hired who were biochemists, working with regulatory people who worked with Trader Joe's, for instance. I think it was pretty well done in the sense that I looked at my own... The concept, and it's been perhaps overquoted, but the idea of scratching your own itch in Silicon Valley is, I think, critically important. So you can, for instance, like, I don't know the first thing about mothers with their first kids. Like, I'm not a mother with a first kid. I can speculate, but when I started my first business, I was like, all right, I make 40 grand a year. I'm working all the time, which means, like, per hour I'm making Burger King wages. And I spend $300-$400 a month on sports nutrition. That's crazy. And all of my friends are the same way. And one of the categories that did not exist really at that point was any type of neural enhancement. So looking at the neurotransmitter side of things to enhance physical performance, which, guess what? Like, that is, and I know a lot of the top Olympic coaches, that is the rumor of how a lot of the Jamaican sprinters are running as fast as they do. It's acetylcholinesterase inhibition, which is exactly one of the properties of what I manufactured in 2001. But looking at the market first and your own behavior and your own spending habits, I think is a great place to start. If you want to create a business that produces seven figures a year or even high six figures in income, that's all you need to do to start. And lastly, I would say read 1,000 True Fans by Kevin Kelly. It's online. It's a couple thousand words maybe. That's all you need to know about marketing.
I think if you look at some of the best writers and reporters out there, it's the ones that love to write about what they're writing about.
Yeah.
It's finding that.
Yeah.
Cool. Hey, Tim, I'm Nathaniel. I'm just curious, based on everything you learned in the last decade, especially this ability to learn, so like an enabling feature, what kind of things now do you see as challenges or obstacles? Like, what are you struggling with or focusing on? Like, what's the horizon?
The learning of skills, whether it's a physical skill like surfing or languages or whatnot, is not overly intimidating to me. It always can be, and you have hurdles and you have plateaus and whatnot, but I'm not intimidated by that. The things that worry me are the disappearing boundaries of privacy, personally. I find that really scary. And, I mean, I know it sounds weird, but it's like I get death threats on a regular basis. I have people who are convinced that I am communicating with them via Facebook with embedded personal messages, who will fly from Canada, I'm not kidding, to go to my old home address to be like, I'm here to see Tim Ferriss. Too bad he's not here. Thumbs up and put it on Twitter. That's creepy. I think. You know, may call me old-fashioned. Those things are very worrisome to me because, like, I can defend myself, you know, especially after shooting deer and stuff. Like, yeah. I have no trouble shooting a stalker. But I do worry about, like, my future wife, my kids. These are real concerns of mine. But, you know, you kind of get what you sign up for. So those are the types of things that I worry about.
But it's not just you, though. I mean, that's everyone.
That's the internet that we live on.
No,
exactly. Yeah. And I think that people mistakenly believe, oh, well, that's you because you have all this high exposure. I would encourage you to take a look at the current issue of Wired magazine in December, which talks about a writer for Wired who had everything hacked, all of his photographs on all of his devices deleted. It's pretty creepy if you want a wake-up call. Not to end on like a very dystopian note, but
we have one more question.
No, exactly. We might get even further.
Make it a good one.
Yeah, yeah. But in any case, those are the types of things that I worry about because they affect people I care about and not just me.
Last dystopian note. Thanks for your talk. I'm Seth. I'm a former teacher, actually, and now run a tutoring company, a hybrid tutoring company. So my question is about a four-hour school week. Yeah. So do you think, and this isn't so much only teaching kids for 4 hours a week, but how can we maximize teachers' time and tutors' time and mentors' time to impact, you know, student achievement, student success?
Yeah, that's a good one to end on. It's a big one. By having more problem solving in the classroom. I think that the model of, for instance, and some people are doing this, having students review textbooks or Khan Academy at home and then coming into class to be supervised when they solve problems in real time is a very undervalued approach. And I think that all the things that apply to adults, this, you know, deconstruction, selection, sequencing, et cetera, including stakes, applies to students. You could very easily overlay that on, let's say, a Montessori school. It would not be hard at all. But there is this, it's hard to quantify, and I'm very involved with a nonprofit called Donors Choose and have been for years, but if I look back at my own academic career, there are three or four teachers who stand out, and if they had not been there, like, I could be in a morgue with, like, heroin injection marks on my arm. I mean, I'm not saying it's that binary, but I could. I mean, it's, if I look at, you know, one of my best friends just died of overdose where I grew up, and the only thing in the fork in the road that separates me from him in a lot of ways is my time I spent with one or two teachers. So figuring out those top performers and modeling them and trying to replicate to the extent possible, I think is really important.
We have 1 minute left, and we are ending our discussion of the event with Mr. Tim Ferriss. And we traditionally, apparently, do this by asking you to say in 60 seconds an idea that will change the world. Dogs on testosterone.
Right. All the performance enhancement that dog chemistry can provide.
You've already used up 15 seconds, so you...
I know. Oh, that's another 10. All right, so do we... If you look at predictors of, let's say, marriage success, or predictors of self-reported well-being, which is a fancy way of saying happiness, if you look at the research of, let's say, Martin Seligman and others, the one thing I would encourage you to do is have at least 2 long dinners a week with multiple friends or family, like 3 to 4 people, 2 to 3 to 4 hours dinners twice a week. Changes everything. And it sounds so simple and so primitive, and it is, and that's exactly why it works so well. So grab that Asabuca recipe. I'm sure it's online already. B-U-K-O, just to make my haters even give me some spelling issue as well. And have some friends over, a bunch of wine, 3 or 4 or 5, 6 people. Do that twice a week. It's really easy to do.
Oh, can we all come over to your house after this?
Yeah, right. You can plate for 150 people, yeah.
Let's give a big round of applause to Tim Ferriss. And I have to bang the gavel and say that the meeting of the Inforum, the Commonwealth Club, is now adjourned.